Nick, my first question for you is, what is the band currently up to? And talk about the current happenings in Redemption.
Yeah, we are busy, busy, busy. In fact, I'm spread way too thin and barely sleeping because my brain's running 300 miles an hour even when I'm trying to sleep. So we do have an album that gets released on the 27th, so about 2 weeks from now, give or take. We are in rehearsals for our headlining performance at Prague Power in September. We're lining up additional tour dates, and after that, I'm dealing with the visas required to get Tom and Simone, our guitar player, over here from Sweden and Italy, respectively. I'm trying to deal with all the pre-production stuff related to the DVD that we're going to be filming in Atlanta when we perform there. And we're also just coming off redesigning our website and building a social media presence and releasing the third of three singles related to the album, for which we shot a video that was incredibly time consuming. That got released a couple of days ago. So we've been extremely busy, but a lot of exciting stuff coming up, and we're pretty fired up about it.
Now, after listening to this album, Nick, I can tell you that the band feels like it has a lot more energy. And it just has a different vibe to it than, you know, some of the other material you've put out. And do these new members in the band, do the new members of this band really contribute to the, you know, not more positive, but, you know, just as a higher energy level and feel to the record? Do the new band members have a lot to do with this?
It's obviously you can't overstate the amount of change that's caused when you replace an iconic singer with another iconic singer. It's disruptive, obviously, but that doesn't necessarily mean in a bad way. It does bring in a tremendous amount of new energy along with new expectations. It inspires us to want to, you know, I told the rest of the band from the time that we knew that Ray wouldn't be doing it, I said, this album has to be our heaven and hell. You know, people, I'm sure, I'm not comparing us in popularity or quality to Black Sabbath, but I'm sure when Ozzy left, people thought it was the end of that band, and I'm sure they felt the need to answer. And, you know, for me, Heaven and Hell is one of the definitive heavy metal records of all time, and that opening of Neon Nights and Dio's vocal performance there is just like, you know, is a microphone drop moment in terms of wow. And so I knew I wanted to, you know, we always want to make a great record, of course. I knew that the bar would have to be raised for this because there would be doubters and people that were questioning whether or not we should continue or would be able to. So I think that's part of it. And Tom's performance, which has a ton of energy to it, is another part of it. And frankly, the amount of time that he invested in getting a great vocal performance and making changes to the arrangements of the vocals, that just his time commitment is significantly more than, I mean, I love Ray and we made a lot of great music together, but that was never his thing. The other piece of it, I think, is the production. We went with Jacob Hansen, who we almost used once in the past. Jacob has, you know, he's known for this really glossy but punchy and powerful sort of modern European sounding metal. Frankly, we're a very difficult band to mix, and we wound up having to, you know, we took 4 months to make this record, which normally, you know, we would expect to be done in 2 to 3 weeks. And we had a lot of back and forth because, and we can get into the dive deep on this if you want to with a follow-up question, but like I said, we're hard to mix, and I think he's used to mixing stuff that responds differently and doesn't, you know, he had to sort of unpack his whole signal chain soup to nuts and redo the way he thinks about things to get to where we want, which is a combination of that power and punch, but also warmth and separation in the, of the instruments. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want something was overcompressed and too hot, but it also, you know, had to have this, you know, urgency and energy to it. So I think we got where it needed to be at the end of the day. Of course, all I ever hear is, well, I do this differently now, or I do that differently now, because I'm a perfectionist, which is sort of a pain. But it's a long way of answering your question, part of which is to say that Jacob definitely, the sound of his recordings bring punch and energy to what we do.
Now, it's interesting that you brought that up, Nick, because one of the recent interviews that I did was with Dennis Ward, and we talked about how a lot of bands really don't have a lot of really good producers being involved with them. And do you think that is a problem in music today, where bands, they don't have an expert that can make records sound great? At least a lot of them don't have that type of person involved with them. And do you think that is something that's a big problem in the music business and the music world?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. There are a number of reasons for that. It's funny you mentioned Dennis, because I love his production. And you know, and Jacob is definitely one of the best in the world, but his first pass at it wouldn't have worked. So it's, you know, we didn't, thankfully, didn't have a deadline that we were backed into. And we've had experiences in the past that didn't turn out as well as we'd hoped. So there are a number of ways in which producers can make a difference. They can make a difference in songwriting. They can make a difference in arrangements. They can certainly make a difference in the way things sound, even going into the mix, just like the way guitars are recorded or the way drums are recorded, or the, you know, if you think about people having signature tones, like, you know, a Van Halen song from the first note, you know, a Pantera song from the first note. That's because, you know, Dime and Eddie have very distinctive tones to their guitars. So there are a million different ways that producers can put their, you know, thumbprints on stuff, and a lot of it does matter, and they're aren't that many, really. I mean, this genre is not selling 500,000 units. You're not getting Mutt Lange to work on a Redemption record. So the biggest producers in the world that were working on albums in the 80s and then working on grunge album in the 90s, there's not as much money in it, both because the business has changed and because tastes have changed. And, you know, somebody was interviewing, I forget who it was, somebody like, it was Kirk Hammett, actually, about whether or not the guitar is still going to be a relevant instrument. Kids growing up now want to learn how to use a turntable rather than play guitar. So there are exceptions, but, you know, it's not written in stone that rock needs to be something that is huge forever, and so you don't have as much talent. And that makes people like Jacob, and there are a few others like Jay Rustin, is a guy whose work I think is phenomenal. There aren't that many that are just really great. And at the same time, it's also, you got to consider, sorry to ramble, the cost of doing it has gone down. People try and do it themselves. You have a lot more self-produced stuff. I wish I could. I know my limitations. I couldn't possibly get to a record that sounds the way I wanted to by myself. So even though I'd rather not spend the money, and I've got all the tools that I could do it with, I just don't have the know-how. And then lastly, there are bands that are big enough to afford it, but sometimes they get to the point where they like the smell of their own cooking so much that they don't have outside influences. And that rarely works out.
Right. You know, a good example of that, you know, of a band that decided, hey, let's get an outside guy in here, was the Judas Priest album.
Yeah, I mean, which is, I think, a phenomenal record.
And now that's a good example of that. And
well, Sneap, by the way, Andy Sneap is one of the absolute greats. So the fact that they brought in Tom Allom and Andy both, which, you know, pays homage to their legacy and you know, the evolution of their sound, but also does so in a really modern, you know, impactful way, I think was brilliant.
One of the things that you always see too is a lot of bands are using the same producer and that works well with them, and they put out a really good record with that person, and then suddenly they decide to stick with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to be pretty loyal. I'd like to work with Jacob again. At the same time, I want every I'm still searching for the perfect sounding record, and we're not quite there with this. I think we're closer than we've ever been. We've been lucky to work with a number of really good producers. We had a great relationship with Tommy Newton. You know, we've bounced around a little bit, but if we find a creative collaboration that works, I like to tend to stick with them. I mean, we've been using Travis as our artistic partner for, you know, 15 years now, and there are a lot of great artists out there. I can't imagine, you know, not using Travis. He's a part of the band at this point.
One of the things that really struck me as surprising is when I was listening to this album, I noticed just how creative the drums were, and that's not something most people listen for, but I listen for everything, and I really thought the drumming on this album was phenomenal.
Yeah, Chris rules. I think he's underrated. Part of it is, frankly, I think you hear the drums better on this than any of the other records. Drums were good on the last one, but here they really pop, and some of that's Jacob, and some of it, frankly, is a back and forth between me and Jacob. I like hearing toms. Some people just like kick and snare. So I wanted these big tom fills that really stood out and were noticeable. And I'm always, you know, Chris has gotten used to me telling him to use the China more now, and we try and push each other a little bit. I told him, even as we were doing the video for someone else's problem, we're in the desert for 8 hours just listening to the song over and over and over as we're playing along with it. And I'm like, you know, next time you should be throwing more fills in the middle of verses. So I think we're only going to get busier in the drum department, but Chris's game, he's a really, really creative drummer and a fantastic guy.
Now, the song Indulge in Color, I thought was absolutely awesome. And maybe talk a bit about that track, because that was one of my favorite tracks on the album so far.
Yeah, you know, there are sort of three sides to our music. We do, and that's all part of the, you know, we try to combine pretty aggressive riffing with pretty strong melody. And there's a sort of what I've taken to calling an emotional urgency to the music. And then there's a cinematic quality of some of the longer pieces. But within that, we sort of have three types of songs. There's the more straightforward, heavy stuff like the opening track, Eyes You Dare Not Face and Dreams. There's the more sort of melodic metal stuff that's got some technicality thrown in, like Someone Else's Problem or Damaged from our last record is also like that, or Walls from Snowfall is like that. And the third category is the sort of more progressive stuff that owes a little bit to prog rock and still it's got plenty of beef to it. And that's sort of Indulge, and the title track I would put in that category as well. Mm-hmm. So Indulge in Color, you know, you can't ever, you always want to write a great record. And you can't say, well, you know, for this song, I'm going to try and make a really great song instead of just a really good song. It's just the songs are what the songs are, and you catch lightning in a bottle once in a while, and you're happy when you do. Mm-hmm. But I did think, I'd had the phrase Indulge in Color popped into my head a couple of years ago. I can't remember the context. I just thought that was a cool title. And as I sort of turned it over in my head, I realized it was a companion piece to Black and White World, which is, I think, one of the best songs I've ever written. Seems to be a fan favorite. Right. And so I thought, well, you know what? What if, not as a sequel, but as a companion piece, since clearly there's a thematic inspiration, can we take some lyrical inspiration from that, and can we also maybe look to the original and get some cues from it to sort of, you know, pollinate the song with some of these ideas and see where it grows. And so it sort of had its roots in that, and I wound up, there are a couple of little lyrical references, but nothing too overt. And then there is a little musical signature at the beginning that's evocative of that other song. So it's sort of a companion piece, but really does have its own life.
Right.
The best part is the chorus, and that sort of came together at the end. And I was, as I'm writing, I'm like, you know, I felt this way with Black and White World, too. It was a risk doing the end of that song, which is this really slow breakdown and then a build back up. And it's, you know, it's lyrics that if they're not delivered with a right emotional conviction can seem a little bit cheesy. And I was afraid that, you know, if we didn't pull it off, it would sound like assholes. But we did pull it off, and I knew when it was coming together that it was going to be awesome. And I had that same feeling here. I'm like, wow, if Tom doesn't sing over major keys a lot, and he, you know, that I attribute this to Los Angeles sun versus Gothenburg gloom, but we're a little bit less, we're 20% less depressing than Evergrey is, so we at least have a happy ending to the songs.
Right.
And I thought, you know, if Tom's versatile enough to do this, if he really invests himself in it, this is going to be really, really special. And it came together beautifully, and, you know, I sing the backing vocals, which are these big pan backing vocals, and Tom didn't want to do them because he thought that it sounded better with the two different types of vocal in it, almost like a King's X sort of way there.
Right.
So it really, it's great. And then the other piece of that is the solo from Chris Poland in the middle of that song is just phenomenal and combines, you know, his unique version of fusion-y shred with some just really great emotional playing.
Now, a song I thought really turned out great was the song New Year's Day, and it's one of my favorites on the record. You know, let's talk a bit about that track.
Well, you obviously, you know, if it's catchy, it's because of Bono and The Edge writing it. So yeah. It's you know, it's we've got a history of adapting sort of songs that you wouldn't, I mean, I even made a joke out of the title on the bonus track or bonus CD for Mortal Coil. These are songs you would not expect would be performed by a progressive heavy metal band.
Right.
You know, I've said this elsewhere, but it bears repeating, probably my two favorite songs ever are Hallowed Be Thy Name and Subdivisions, and neither of those need to be done by a heavy metal band. First of all, the originals are perfect, and you don't try to improve on perfection.
Right.
And second, you know, you just don't need another heavy metal band playing Hallowed Be Thy Name. It's been done, right? So we I don't want to play a heavy metal song. So we look for songs that have stood the test of time that are undeniably just good songs. It could be something by The Who, it could be something by Toto, it could be something by U2 in this case.
Right.
And we looked at classic rock and sort of what was called new wave back then. as you know, sources of great songs. Others have done Depeche Mode really, really well. That, you know, it's a band that I couldn't stand at the time, but in hindsight, they're good songs, and if you give them the proper kind of treatment, you can bring out what's great about them without bringing out stuff that's not so great. So we record stuff like this for every record. Some stuff we do and it doesn't work out and we don't release it. We did, like, oddly enough, a mashup of Peter Gabriel's Salisbury Hill with Rush's Red Barchetta maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And it's cool, but it's a little too affected and it just didn't sound, it just wasn't ready for prime time. So we tried this almost experimentally because I'd heard it playing on the radio and I thought, you know what, let's see if we can make it our own. And I think we did a good job of it musically. And then Tom came in and did a great job on vocals. And then Simone, you know, the original guitar solo is pretty minimalist, but it's so iconic that I knew we had to have that. So I played that and I told Simone, let's beef this up. And he came back with some really tasteful shred.
Right. Yeah, I was quite taken aback by that one.
You know, what's interesting though, there's one thing unique to that song. One of the things that makes us difficult to mix is a lot of the time you get the heaviness of a band from having the bass play the same lines as the guitar. And if you look at Evergrey, which, you know, had obviously bears some similarities to us, and they're far from the only band that does this, they've got very aggressive riffing, and it's made that much heavier because the bass is playing along with the guitar, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
We use the bass as an extended range instrument. It's all over the place. It's got 6 strings. It's playing in counterpoint to what the guitar is doing and not usually following along with the guitar. It's hard to actually, you know, mix for a variety of reasons. On the low end of the bass, it's stepping on the kick drum frequencies. On the high end, it's stepping on the low end of the guitar. And so it's really tough. The heaviest part on this record is the last verse in New Year's Day, where it's just dun 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 dun, but the bass is playing along with the guitar, and mm-hmm. it's so heavy. And we don't have the advantage of that in 90% of what we do, which is part of what makes Jacob's job so difficult, is getting that the crunch and the beef without the advantage of having that bass. But it's remarkable. You go back and listen to that third verse, it's the least heavy song on the album, or should be from a compositional standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But that last gunk, 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 gunk is so heavy. It's pretty awesome.
So obviously you get a new singer in a band, and you know, that individual comes in, and how much impact did he have on the songwriting for this new album?
So he hasn't had that much of an impact on the songwriting yet, but I expect that's going to change dramatically going forward. Although we're in agreement that one of the things we want to do to preserve Redemption as being distinct from Evergrey is he shouldn't be writing songs. He should be taking stuff that I start with and tweaking it and mm-hmm. making suggestions and, you know, making the melodies his own. But if he's singing and he's doing the songwriting, it's inevitable that it's going to, and it's metal and it's produced in this style, it's going to sound closer to Evergrey than we would want it to. So I think I'll be writing, and I'll be working with Vikram, our keyboardist, and we'll, you know, be of course involving Tom in that and getting his feedback and getting his involvement, but it'll start with me so that it still has the mm-hmm. soul of Redemption intact. As far as picking him, look, we knew there would be big questions when Ray left. We wanted somebody that would command immediate respect. Somebody has to be a great vocalist, but it's more than just being able to sing, because we could have had, you know, Michael Kiske is one of my favorite vocalists of all time. I love Helloween. He wouldn't have worked in Redemption. Not that he would ever deign to do it, but it's just not, we need somebody that conveys our lyrics with emotional conviction. Mm-hmm. And there aren't a lot of singers that can do that. Ray is very, very, very good at that style of singing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the only person who's conveys more emotion in his vocals than Ray is Tom. So he checked that box. He obviously has a formidable track record and following, and there's a ton of professional respect for what he's done. And he's been a friend of 20 years. And, you know, we agreed to sit down and talk about it. And I remember he said, if the music sucks, can I tell you? And I said, if the music sucks, you better tell me. So once he knew that he wasn't going to be forced to put his name on something that he didn't believe in, and he could throw himself behind it fully creatively, I knew it was the right choice.
You know, listening to the title track of the album and the song Someone Else's Problem, I thought those songs were great, and lyrically those are my two favorites. And talk about those two tracks.
So Someone Else's Problem oddly, it's disguised as a, well, particularly visually, it's disguised as a romantic relationship, but it is, frankly, was not inspired by that. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but there are many types of relationships, whether they be familial or interpersonal or friendships or people that you work with or romantic relationships, of course, where you find yourself making excuses for a number of reasons or just sort of powering through the shortcomings of another person that normally would drive you crazy, but you sort of, whether because you're infatuated or because you have to or because it's a situation of convenience, you just sort of ignore it, right? And then when the relationship runs its course, you're free to sort of stop pretending that this person was perfect for whatever role they played in your life, mm-hmm. and now become somebody else's problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's basically it. I think that's something that we can all relate to on some level or another. There's
right.
an element of catharsis there. And, you know, but then the companion piece to that on this record is the song And Yet, which is, even though I've gotten this person out of my life, the part of me misses what they brought to it. So it's, you know, human life is complicated.
You know, the lyrics in the title track of this album, I think, are great. It gives off a vibe of being in life and dealing with a lot of trials and tribulations. And I relate the lyrics to that song to This Mortal Coil, which obviously quite a bit of those tracks and the songs and the lyrics are about, you know, some of your real life hardships that you had to deal with. Let's elaborate a little bit on the title track of the album, which in my opinion is probably my favorite song on this entire record.
All right, so a couple of points that I should make. I'm sorry, I meant to answer your question about the title track in the previous response. That's another one where I had the title concept before I had the song, and that had been kicking around my head. I think even before Art of Loss, I had the idea that the phrase "Long Night's Journey into Day," which is, you know, there's a famous play by Eugene O'Neill called "Long Day's Journey into Night," and I always thought sort of inverting that would be, you know, clever wordplay and sort of consistent with, you know, I don't pretend to be a philosopher of any type. If we have a philosophy behind our general lyrics, since we don't sing about dragons and trolls, the penetrating mists of the Carpathian forest or whatever, our lyrical philosophy is life is a struggle, and there's a lot of fear and anxiety and loss and frailty, but there's also a tremendous amount of beauty and joy and love and courage and everything else positive. And, you know, nothing's given to you on a silver platter. You buckle down, you deal with what you have to deal with, and it's almost always worth the struggle. And that's sort of what I took to encapsulate, you know, that, or what I chose that song to sort of, following that title, sort of present that overall philosophy.
Right.
And then it came down to, I had the notion that I wanted a, quote, big finish, unquote, for the song. And I had written the music, and it was this, you know, recurring theme that keeps building and adding orchestration. And I was in the mode of just, when I write, I'll sing like a nonsense lyrical line, which is usually na, 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 just to get a melody down, and then I'll put lyrics to it. But something inspired this keep on dreaming phrase, and I think that just actually sort of really made the ending of the song work, and then I sort of backed from there and wove this notion of, you know, you dream big and inevitably sometimes you're going to be let down, but it doesn't mean you should stop.
Right.
So that's where that came from. And, you know, as far as Mortal Coil, you know, I'm the lyrics to all of our work really can come across as autobiographical. They're not. I'm able to empathize with, you know, common elements of being a person. I've been happily married for 25 years, so someone else's problem is not about a relationship that I've had, but it's about, you know, we can all sort of relate to that. And even in the case of Mortal Coil, which was absolutely influenced by my own cancer diagnosis, I didn't want it to be a pity party, and I didn't really want it to be just an autobiographical thing. So I even went to Chris, our drummer, who's been the longest standing member of the band and also a lyricist for his band Primary. I said, look, I don't want this to just be about me. So be a second set of eyes on this stuff. Obviously, it's there's no escaping the fact that it's influenced by what happened to me. But it's not about a cancer diagnosis so much as it is about the notion of coming to grips with the inevitability of your own mortality, and that's something that we all mm-hmm. have to deal with at some point in time. So it's personal, but it's personal insofar as all human beings are persons.
So, you know, we talked about Chris Poland and some of the other guests that you've had on records, and if there were some people out there that you could work with and have as a guest on a Redemption album, who would they be?
A couple of them are dead. I would have loved to. In fact, I was going to, particularly once he found out that he was also sick. There's one line in this off Mortal Coil, Stronger Than Death, which is vis-a-vis the cancer. You tried to kill me, but I've killed you.
And right.
That requires a lot of beef to the vocal performance, and Ray managed to pull it off. But I had always had in my mind, I want Dio to sing that one line,
right?
Which would have been amazing, but. Unfortunately, he was not as lucky as I was in terms of the outcome of his treatment. So, you know, I'm very fortunate. I've worked with amazing, amazing musicians and guest performers. And, you know, I got to play golf with Alex Lifeson, which was a tremendous fantasy wish fulfillment for me. But I don't even know that I'd want, you know, Alex Lifeson on a record as much as I want the people that we've got playing on it now. I mean, Chris Poland is as talented as they come. Simone is unbelievable. And, you know, Vikram's probably the most talented musician I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure there are others if I thought about it. But and I love collaborating, and I'm honored that people are even remotely interested in doing it. And, you know, I wouldn't have thought, although I've always respected him, I wouldn't have thought John Bush as an absolute necessity, but I think back on our catalog, and one of the things I'm most proud of is the unbelievable job he did on our Who cover when we did that
right.
For the last record. So that was an amazing collaboration. I'm deeply honored that he wanted to do that. So we'll see. You know, I respect and like a lot of musicians, and if the song calls for a guest performance, we'll see who might fit in.
Now that you have a new vocalist and, you know, everybody, I know everybody has their commitments, but, you know, I know Ray was more committed to Fate's Warning, hence, you know, why he really couldn't be part of the band. But, you know, does this enable you to maybe play more shows?
Without getting into the politics of that, let's say that there are some things happen because of logistical issues, and mm-hmm. some things happen for other reasons. I don't think the actual logistical issues were responsible for our challenges in performing in the past. The reality is I've got a 60-hour a week day job, and it's a big boy job. I can't just take 4 months of the year off and tour.
Right.
So I'm going to be limited in what I can do, which means that, you know, it doesn't bother me that Tom's first obligation is to Evergrey.
Right.
Because I'm not in a position to demand 6 months of his time per year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're a band that every 18 months will release an album and we'll play out for, you know, 10 dates in between albums.
Right.
And that's something that's, you know, obviously this was very important to both Tom and me that we discussed this up front.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, it's always challenging to go out and play. Plus, the economics don't really work that well. But I don't think it's certainly not going to be any harder. I don't think it'll be harder or easier than it was before, because the gaining factor really is my job, if I'm honest.
Now that you got people in the band, new people in the band that are from, you know, other countries, again, you know, it makes it a lot more difficult to get them to be able to play shows over here too.
It's expensive to get them over here, I'll say that
right,
much.
Right.
I mean, the logistics of getting a visa and the cost involved, it's prohibitive. And, you know, but that, on the one hand, it makes it harder. On the other hand, it makes me want to try and do more, because it's even worse doing it for a one-off than it is to do it for a dozen dates. So, it all factors in. So, calendar, cost, logistics, and demand, frankly.
Right.
It's not like we're going to show up in Cleveland and play at a club and draw 2,000 people. So.
I don't think there's even 2,000 people to draw, but hey, anyway.
Yeah.
So, knowing Tom is going to be in the band, and knowing when you're going to be going down to write some songs, you know, is the songwriting going to be a little bit different now that you have a different singer? You know, I know you mentioned earlier in the interview that when it came to Tom, you know, one of the things that happened was he wasn't part of the songwriting process. So now that he's in the band and he possibly will be, you know, involved, you know, how is your songwriting going to change, or is it going to change?
I don't think it'll change much. I mean, I think, again, it helps that Evergrey and Redemption both write songs in the same style, which is it's about real people problems as opposed to fantasy stuff. And, I probably owing to the fact that it's sunny in Los Angeles and cloudy in Gothenburg, we usually have a happy ending, and people don't just, you know, it's not like every song ends with, I'm going to go to the rope store and then to the stool store.
Right.
So, I don't see us changing really the stuff that we write about all that much. And I don't, you know, I mentioned earlier, I think there'll be a element of his involvement in the songwriting that's going to help us grow musically and push us to do our best work. And certainly Vikram's going to be very involved in that aspect of it as well. So
right.
It's a work in progress. We'll see. I think another thing that might happen is Tom might have more influence over not even so much the shape of the melody line, but maybe some of the voicing of it and where it sits, so that if it's in a part of his range where he's able to do something different with it than he would otherwise do, maybe that's, you know, he'll have a bit more of an opportunity to weigh in on that.
Now, my last question is I always ask everybody, any last words for the fans that are going to be checking out this interview?
Sure. So that's how you always end it. I always respond to that question by just honestly thanking people for their interest and their support. You know, we don't have the biggest fan base in the world, but we've got an amazing fan base. We love our fans. The connection that we have with them, you know, when our music works, it really works on a deep level, and we are constantly inspired by the connection we have with our audience and very appreciative of it. So thanks to all of you.